This is a Studio 2 Extra. I'm Cherry Gregg. My guest is Celeste Ng, one of today's most celebrated voices in contemporary fiction. She's the best-selling author of Everything I Never Told You and the TV-adapted Little Fires Everywhere. Both are stories that explore family, identity, belonging, and the complicated ways we connect to each other. Her latest novel, Our Missing Hearts, is the Free Library's pick for this year's One Book, One Philadelphia. The story is dystopian, but only slightly removed from reality. It imagines a near future America shaped by fear, censorship, and division. It's exactly the kind of book that stays with you long after you finish it, and now thousands of Philadelphians are reading and discussing its themes together in libraries, book clubs, and community events across the city. I sat down recently with Celeste Ng to talk about the timely, emotional, and deeply human story in Our Missing Hearts.
So the story is about a 12-year-old boy named Bird, that's his nickname, and he is mixed race. His mother is a Chinese-American woman, and his father is white. And when the book opens, he's living with just his father. His mother has left the family, and he doesn't totally understand why. And throughout the course of the book, he's going on a journey trying to find his mother. And along the way, he starts to understand that the world is not exactly what he thought. He learns, for example, that there's a lot of restrictions on freedom of speech, that there used to be books and stories available that are no longer on the bookshelves. He's used to libraries having empty shelves, and he learns, oh, that wasn't always the case. He learns, for example, that there's a lot of kind of state-sanctioned racism happening against Asians in particular, and he learns that that wasn't always the case. And he starts to understand the roots of where all of this came from. So that's the world of the book, and unfortunately, many of those things are starting to be more apparent in our own world as well. Every dystopia has its roots in real life events. Mm-hmm. Margaret Atwood, in one of the most famous dystopias of all time, The Handmaid's Tale, talked about wanting to create an imaginary garden, but having real toads in it. It's always hard to see the things in your own life or your own world that are happening. And mm-hmm. when you get a little bit of distance, sometimes it's a little easier to see parallels when you're able to pretend for a minute that it's not your world.
Yeah. And you get yourself enough distance so you can actually take it in and do some analysis. In the book, you created the Preserving American Culture and Traditions Act, or PACT. How much of that was sort of shaped by what was happening around us in the real world? Like I'm thinking about the pandemic, and there was all kinds of laws that popped up. Yeah.
There were all kinds of laws that popped up. And one of the things I learned while doing this research was that actually there's all kinds of laws that have been popping up, and they kind of came to flower during the pandemic. That a lot of the laws that we're seeing now, book bannings, to take one that is very obvious in the book, those laws have actually been working their way through the system slowly over the past 10 years. And it's only now that we're starting to actually see them gain public recognition, but that those roots have gone all the way back. So a lot of this came to mind during the pandemic. And when I began to research, I realized that actually they've been in the works for a long time. A lot of the restrictions on immigration, a lot of the restrictions on books, on free speech in general, a lot of restrictions on protests, for example. Certainly those were coming to a head during Black Lives Matter, but there had been pushback against the idea of, well, how much do we let people protest? How much free speech is really too much free speech? It was a revelation to me, just as I think it is to the main characters in the book, to learn that actually these threats have always been there.
Yeah. You told us a little bit about Bird, the main character. Noah is his actual legal name in the book, and the world that he was growing up in. Why choose a young boy, a 12-year-old boy, to be the navigator through this world?
Well, in part, I'm always really interested in parent-child relationships. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it seemed really appropriate to tell the story through the eyes of an adolescent who was sort of waking up to the world that was around him. Mm-hmm. I think if we're lucky, when we're children, the world feels very small. And then as you get older, as your world expands, you get more context and you understand more history and you understand more your place in the world and that there are other ways to be. Many people in the world of the novel and maybe in our world are realizing, oh, there's another side to the world than what I thought there was.
Yeah, it's so interesting because Bird's mother, Margaret, she's a vibrant, rebellious person who the state viewed as dangerous. His father, Ethan, careful, quiet, worked really hard, just trying to survive, right? Tell us about these two characters and what they represent to Bird and to the readers.
Bird's parents, I think, represent two possible paths. I mean, those are his two roots, right? His parents. But his mother, being the child of immigrants, being a person of color, being the one who is the risk taker, versus his father, who is less of a risk taker, is more play it safe, keep your head down. Those are the two sort of routes that are available to him, and he has to sort of decide which one of those routes he's going to take. Now, the route that's available to his father, keep your head down, that's not always available to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. If you are a person of color, if you stand out in any way, sometimes you are made visible in times that you don't want to be visible. And as a child who is multiracial, Bird is trying to figure out where he sits in that sort of formula, where it is that he can stand out and where it is that he could hide. And does he want to do that? I think, you know, when we think about how we're going to act in the world, we often like to think, well, if I saw an injustice being done, I would step up and I would do that. But there are really valid reasons that sometimes people don't do that, right? And deciding how it is that you're going to respond to your fear was one of the questions that I was thinking about in writing this book. You can let that fear make you small, mm-hmm. or you can use that fear and put it towards something else. And the idea of doing something with your fear was really powerful to me, and something that also came into the book.
Yeah, and you saw Bird sort of trying to figure out as he slowly started to discover that, you know, my mom, who she was, because at first he kind of knew, but he didn't really know. Was it fun sort of doing the slow reveal to your readers in that way?
It was fun. It was also another part of having a young child as one of the main characters. You know, when I was an adolescent, I think, like maybe many of us, I didn't really think of my parents as people. You know, they're
your
parents. And it's only when you get to be a little bit older, you know, if you're very lucky, that you realize, oh, my parents have a life outside of me. They have opinions, they have things they want to do, and they had things before me too, right? In some ways, I think that coming of age really is sort of recognizing that your parents and everyone else around you has this other existence. They're not just the little bit of person that you used to see. And so guiding Bird along that journey of realizing that there was a lot more to his mother than he had realized, and mm-hmm. there's a lot more to his father too, that was one of the pleasures of the book, is letting this character open up his eyes in that way.
Yeah, so interesting. And I don't want to give spoilers because I really want people to read Our Missing Heart. And you mentioned that this book, you know, centers on an Asian American mother, a white father, a biracial son, a family structure that kind of mirrors your own life and overlaps in your own life. Did it make it feel a little bit more vulnerable for you to have to write something that in some ways is a reflection, but very different?
It did, actually. It's always one of those things that writers face. But if you write about anything, people will say, is this really about you? And the answer is always no, but also yes, in a way. The characters in this book are not me and my family, but a lot of the things that they're wrestling with at their core mm-hmm. are things that I think about. I think about, how do I raise a child who is never going to have the same experience that I have? I'm a Chinese American woman. I'm a child of immigrants, as is my character. But my son's experience as a multiracial person is going to be different than mine.
Yeah.
And I can guess parts of it, but I also have to recognize that it's not going to be the same as mine. And I won't know what his experience is. The same with his father, right? He'll have some experiences that are like his father, but his father also won't know exactly what experience that is. And so grappling with some of those questions, and then mm-hmm. grappling with larger questions, like how do you raise a child in a world that feels like it's very hostile to them? How do you raise a child to try and do good or even survive when it just feels like the entire world is falling apart? Those were things very much on my mind when I started writing this book in earnest in 2020, 2021. You don't want to say to a child, look, everything is just terrible, so just give up and do whatever you want. We might as well just all lie down and die. No one wants to say that to a child, right? But you have to find some way to give them hope and say, there's a reason for us to keep trying to make the world better. There's a reason to believe that as a culture, as a species, we're going to get through this, and it's worth fighting for those things. Those were questions that I was really wrestling with myself, and it did feel kind of vulnerable to put that on the page.
And during the time that you were writing this novel, there was a lot of anti-Asian American and just anti-Asian
yes.
hate that was happening in America during the COVID pandemic. Just how did that find its way into the book? Did you feel that part of it coming into your writing?
When anti-Asian violence started happening in the wake of COVID-19 spreading, a lot of propaganda of people referring to it by derogatory names that put the blame on Asians, generally speaking, it was really a surprise to a lot of people that I knew who were not Asian, and not a surprise to all of the Asians that I knew. I think that, you know, when something is a threat to you, your community, to people who look like you, you're very aware of it. And for other people, it's not on their radar. You know, they don't have that sense because they've never had to worry about that. And so I wanted to put some of that in the book. I wanted to highlight that and to give the sense, if, you know, readers hadn't realized that before, what it might be like to walk around in a skin and realize that people look at you and think that you are a foreigner. When I started writing the book, I knew that I was going to write about Asian American experience, and specifically, I should say, East Asian experience, people who look something like me as a Chinese American woman. But I didn't want to make it sound as if no other groups had faced this, right? There is obviously a very long tradition in the United States, in the world in general, of discriminating against Black people, Indigenous people, any person of color, really, anybody who looks different. And so while I wanted to keep my focus on sort of what I knew I could tell truly and I could speak to from experience, I wanted to make sure to acknowledge in the book that there were many other groups who are fighting similar battles. We might not always have had the exact same experience, but that there is a kinship. If the pandemic taught me anything, it's really that any problem we see affects many people, and that the roots of those problems always go very deep. And in order to address those problems, we need to go back to the roots, and we need to work together in solidarity and recognize that these are shared struggles and move forward together.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because this book came out in 2022. And since then, though, even more of the reality sort of painted in within this dystopia have become reality. Did you have any idea that more and more of the issues that you wrote into the book would become real world issues?
People have been asking me over the past few years, you know, are you psychic? Are you an oracle? And I always tell them, no, I am not any kind of oracle. I looked at history and I can recognize patterns. I was doing a lot of research about past times in which authoritarians took power, lots of other cases in which civil liberties were curtailed in the United States, elsewhere, lots of times in which people were pushing back against those as well. I was seeing that moving towards us, and I hoped that our world and the world I was making in the book would get farther apart. And instead, they've gotten a little bit closer together. But my hope is that as those parallels become more and more clear, more and more people will see them and realize this isn't the way we want to be.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't lost on me that you also touched upon freedom of the press. I work in media. I'm a journalist, and there's a lot of pressure. And you even touch upon that. That's why I'm just like, did you have any? I mean, and I guess we had a little bit of that several years ago, but we had actual journalists being arrested recently covering protests. So, and that kind of happened in your book.
It happened too during a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests. There were several cases in which people would be arrested and they kept their cameras rolling, like amazing, you know, bravery, so that they could kind of testify about what was happening. And we're seeing that, as you said, much more now and much more overtly. We're seeing, for example, people who are not strictly journalists, but, you know, like late night entertainers who are being censured, being fired or attempted to be fired for what they're daring to say. And that's authoritarianism. And I think, you know, we're starting to see like is that the way that we want our country to be? I mean, I think that's the moment that we're at of kind of deciding, are we going to go down that road? And if not, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. And the book sort of poses the question of what happens when stories disappear Why do you think that that question matters so much right now?
I think we are in a period in which parts of our government are trying to erase those stories very overtly. That's always been a thing that happens. But to take one example that your listeners are probably very familiar with, there is a big debate happening right now on, are we allowed to mention that George Washington enslaved people? You're seeing at national parks, at national monuments, literal orders from the executive branch saying, you are not allowed to say anything that makes America look bad. When you erase those stories, you're erasing a lot of things. You're erasing the experiences of those people who were enslaved or who were moved off their land or who were pioneers in trying to create more justice. You're erasing any possibility that we might learn from those stories and try and do better. And that's before we even start talking about the book bannings that are happening all around the country, the restrictions that are happening on journalists, the restrictions that are happening on people on social media, you know, people who are saying you can't come in the country because you maybe said something once that makes America not sound good. These are really big questions to be thinking about. And it feels like something that I hope people will start thinking about and talking about and acting on.
Yeah, I think the book underscores the power of words. Our missing hearts. This was a battle cry in a lot of ways to the people living in the world you created. And I think about all the different battle cries that we've had over the years amidst struggle. I have a dream, you know, like you think about the world. Every single time there's this clash where we're trying to decide what kind of country this is, there's a word or a phrase that becomes a battle cry. What were you trying to express there? And, you know, when you say our missing hearts, this Margaret didn't even mean for her poetry to become the battle cry, but it did.
Exactly. It's a line from one of her poems. And as it turns out, that wasn't exactly what she was talking about in the poem, right? But it becomes this rallying cry for a group. And I think really it speaks about the power of stories, but art in general, that sometimes people need one concrete example of something to hold on to. When we're thinking about these really large societal issues, a lot of times it becomes so abstract that people can't really get their heads around it. But when you get one particular story, if you get like a George Floyd, for example, you have the name of someone, you have a face, you have a story. In a way, that allows the story to be concrete and real, and that allows people to hang on to it. You have to be careful not to forget that there's many more people like that, right? For you know, George Floyd, there's thousands more of those cases, right? But it is a way of humanizing what is otherwise just this abstract problem. And sometimes having a word that somebody wrote or a picture that somebody made or a story that somebody told you, a lot of times that can galvanize a movement in a way that a list of statistics doesn't.
And I wonder, since we're talking about art, I mean, fiction writing, what do you think fiction can do in moments like this? In moments where we're dealing with a lot of the questions we just talked about, what can fiction do that you think other forms of writing may not get at?
Yeah, this is something I was grappling with a lot while I was writing the novel because I was feeling so helpless in 2020, 2021. I was thinking, you know, if I had gone to med school and I was a doctor, I could be saving people's lives. And instead, I'm here writing stories about people who don't exist. I realized after a lot of soul searching that one of the things I was turning to give myself the strength to get through the day was art that people had made. I was reading poems. I was listening to my favorite music to just psych myself up to just get through to lunchtime. And if you're reading fiction, you know that this is a story that did not literally happen in this way. And just that little act of imagining, but what if it did? Here's what it might be like. I do feel like that's really important because when we're in situations like we are now, it's kind of hard to remember that the world was ever a different way. I have a really hard time remembering that there was a time in which I would open up the news and I would not be filled with anger and horror and sadness. But it is true. And I think that fiction almost, it's like a little doorstop. It props open the door to remind you that there's other ways of being than the way that we're in now. It takes you out of this world, even if just for a minute. And I do think that's really important because otherwise, if we can only see the moment around us, it's so easy to despair. I wanted this book to give people hope. I wrote it to give myself hope, in fact.
And so now this book is the One Book, One Philadelphia pick. What was your reaction when you got the news?
I was stunned, honestly, and honored and incredibly excited. It meant a lot to me that the Free Library and, you know, the city of Philadelphia thought that this was a book that was worth, you know, reading and talking about together. I love Philadelphia as a city. Mm-hmm. I love community reads because there are very few opportunities for people to come together and talk about things, maybe particularly now. Reading is so often solitary. And yet when you get to talk to other people about what you're reading and say, oh, I thought it was this. What did you think? Oh, you thought it was something different. Let's talk about that. I feel like that's such a powerful connection. And that's one of the nicest things that literature can do is just get people talking to each other. So I was thrilled. I think I thought about it for all of about 3 seconds before I checked my calendar, made sure I could go, and then wrote back and said yes.
Absolutely. So what are you most curious to hear from Philadelphia readers after they read this book?
I'm really curious to hear about what it gets them thinking about what one person can do in the face of really big societal problems. Can I do anything to affect the direction the country is going in? And I usually try and write books where those questions are open-ended. But in this one case, I do sort of hope that people will come out of the book feeling empowered and feeling that whatever they do, it does make a difference. It isn't just going to be lost in the ether. Everything that you do makes a ripple effect.
That was author Celeste Ng. Her 2022 novel, Our Missing Hearts, is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia selection by the Free Library of Philadelphia. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder and Hazel Mae Bryan. Paige Murray-Bessler edited this interview. Diana Martinez engineered this extra. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for joining me.